How is stress strengthening or damaging me, you, your partner, and our society? We'll discuss this and much more on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes, as always, those are my babies. Thanks for getting Daddy started today. Mwah. Author and researcher Dr. Mary Wingo is with us today, and I'm curious. If it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. If you believe that, then what's the problem with stress?
Good morning. Good morning, Frank. I will tell you what the problem with stress is. What it is that we have not framed stress as a risk assessment type of approach, and that is what I aim to do. Put our perspective of stress at the same levels as we would, with whether we choose to smoke or not, or whether we choose to wear a seatbelt or a motorcycle helmet. It's basically the same thing.
Okay. So help me. You did clarify. The first thing that popped into my head as soon as you said we don't frame it as a risk assessment type of approach, I was thinking, what is she talking about?
Right.
But you did. You brought it home when you said smoking, helmet. Okay, so I have examples, but would you clarify with a definition of some sort what a risk assessment type of approach is?
Well, for many, I've been studying this for many, many years, and one thing that basically all physiologists, stress researchers, psychologists, understand, but have not been able to frame properly, is the fact that stress is when we undergo stress, it is an actual risk assessment that we really, really, really need to reframe this as, because what we're experiencing today, especially in the U.S., is an unprecedented amount of disease and early death and disability caused by stress. And this has been exploding parabolically since the 1950s. But in the last, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and especially in the last few years, it's really become a problem. And it's become such a problem that it's truly in front of our face. It's like the 900-pound gorilla in the room that nobody's talking about. It's affecting our collective public health. And I kept waiting for somebody else to write this book, for somebody, smarter and more prestigious. I haven't actually been in science for 10 years, been a small business person. Mm-hmm. Since nobody else was going to do this, and we have in front of us an impending humanitarian crisis, I figured that I needed to do this to at least bring to the foreground, the public's attention, and hopefully to policymakers and healthcare providers' attention, just how important it is to truly, truly get a hold and manage our preventable stress, because most of this is preventable.
Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show for you, my brethren, who, like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and the information that'll help create loving and flexible parents and partners. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show via Blog Talk Radio, please follow us, and if via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get the show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please give us a favorable iTunes rating and please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my super-duper co-host, Nancy Goring.
Hi, Frank.
Hey, hey, the consummate generalist.
Indeed.
Ha-ha. Be interesting to see what you got to teach me today, what you picked up along the last week.
Along the last hour and a half in the, in the car.
We've got a special guest today.
Okay.
She was born in the U.S., where she earned a Ph.D. in human stress research from the University of North Texas. And in 2014, she immigrated to Ecuador, a tiny country in South America, for you, those of you who didn't know. And she lived there in a very new and different society. Mm-hmm. She notes this environment opened her eyes to the unsustainable social, economic, and political costs that preventable stress causes in our fast-paced world. Her aim is to clearly explain to you and I the biological mechanisms behind the stress response, as well as its staggering costs to society. So, if you, like me, want to know how stress affects us and our relationships, why she decided to write a book on stress, and why has modern society seen such an explosion in stress-related illness and early death? Then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks about stress and its effects with author and researcher, Dr. Mary Wingo. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Frank.
Of course. Before we get too deep into today's subject matter, I want us to all check in to see what's kind of going on in the world around relationships. Doc, please don't be bashful. We certainly want your thoughts, too. You got anything for me today, Nancy?
Actually, before I left out, I heard a tiny clip on what sleeping together does to the longevity of a relationship. And I was like, wow, okay, what you got?
Well, what did they say?
They had nothing.
Really?
It was a Sleepy's commercial. I was burning mad that I stood there waiting for the thing. And yet I found myself saying, wow, I wonder if that makes a difference. And then, of course, I went into, well, if it made a difference, everybody who was married and sleeping in the same bed would still be together. And then I thought about...
Not necessarily.
That's my point. That's my point. It's like if it made a critical difference, mm-hmm. then every... Because at least we want to think initially the people share the same bed, but they have... The point that the ad was making was that people had different sleep habits and how they negotiate those different sleep habits mm-hmm. and still sleep in the same bed. And we know all kinds of technology exists now in terms of mattresses. Mm-hmm. And yet... Where I found my mind going was the couples I know that are still married and they have separate bedrooms and they have great marriages. Mm-hmm. And I was just like,
I'm the first to say, we don't know whether anybody's got a great marriage.
Well, you are the first to say that, and I agree. Well, let's say the game face of the marriage uh-huh. is phenomenal.
Okay.
So I'm like, wow, what is that? Like, mm-hmm. I can't imagine being married and not sleeping not sharing the same bed with my partner all the way through.
Mm, interesting.
That just wouldn't be...
You don't see it as tenable.
It's obviously tenable, but it just...
For you.
It's not attractive to me. Mm. It doesn't appeal to me. Mm-hmm. So, which is funny because I'm always looking at... one of the first questions I ask is, do you snore? Like, I'm always interviewing for, I sleep with this person?
Well, see, that's interesting because you...
Me too.
Yeah.
You got something on that, Mary?
She said me too. Uh-huh. See?
It's interesting because you have now interjected a variable that might cause you to share a different room. Imagine if you were married, things were going well, person didn't snore, and then person starts snoring, like rocking the house snoring.
Well, that's a health issue.
Well, it may be a health issue, but it may be your health issue too if you can't sleep.
If I can't sleep?
Yeah.
Mm.
Would you figure that maybe we change rooms, maybe we have a separate room. Would that become doable for you?
Well, my partner snoring wouldn't, especially if he didn't snore in the beginning and then he began to snore, it wouldn't have me end the relationship.
All right.
It's not that intense.
So would you consider a separate room?
Oh, I would definitely consider it. It just would be, I guess I could go from saying it would be hurtful or sad or, you know, all those drama related.
Yeah, that is things. Drama.
I could take the drama out of it and say that, you know, yeah, I could do it. I could sustain a relationship or marriage where I didn't share the same room with my partner. I just wouldn't want to.
All right. That's not the conditions you would prefer.
Right.
Gotcha.
Right.
Oh, don't look at me.
You weigh in, sir.
Do you actually have to share a bed for more than 45 minutes with somebody? That's a joke. Kind of a joke.
I was really about to open that up.
Right. I was just like, what?
I will say this, and I know why you looked at me. I've been married 32 years.
Yes.
Sleeping together, and not to get too personal, but it's the most intimate part of my day.
Mm.
Whether there's any kind of activity going on or just I'm sharing a bed with someone I love, and that's
right.
how we are intimate.
Right.
There's a dog between us sometimes. You know, there were stretches in the marriage where there were kids between.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the sanctuary. And yes, yeah. I snore, and yes, she snores, and I wear a CPAP machine now, and you just deal with it.
Right.
We have other bedrooms now that the kids are gone. There's beds in there. I can run in there if I feel like it.
Sure.
And it's usually only when one of us thinks we're ill and might give it to the other
okay.
person.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Otherwise, that's just how I live.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
have for most of my life.
Right. Right.
Mary, what you got?
Yes. Well, but I have no comment at all.
All right.
Except
all right.
that I avoid snorers like the plague.
Are you a light sleeper, Mary?
Yes, very, very light sleeper. Although I have cured most of my lifelong genetically based insomnia. I have.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I find the sleeping together conversation to be a bit interesting because one thing, I sleep, when you sleep with someone, and mind you, I have a wife and I have a queen size bed.
Plenty
and,
of room.
You know, it's, I consider it plenty of room.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a way that you sleep when you're sleeping with someone. You sleep in a line. You almost have to. I mean, you have...
Because you're sharing the space.
Yeah, you can't sleep really diagonally, but so much. You can a little bit, but you still... There has to be some type of order. You have to accommodate for your partner.
Okay.
And I notice a mild difference when I'm traveling, I'm in a hotel bed, and, you know, it's generally a king size bed, I think.
Right.
And I get to just
sprawl.
I get to sprawl all over the bed. I'm
He's
everywhere.
A sprawler.
Right.
Okay.
Versus when I'm sharing the bed with my wife. It's, you know, and I don't mind sharing the bed. I'm not complaining at all.
Would you say you sleep better?
I don't know. I think it's possible. I do.
That even though you have to accommodate her, you actually sleep more peacefully.
Yeah, but there are other conditions, too. So when I'm traveling, I typically don't have to get up in the morning to take kids anywhere.
Okay.
I don't have to get kids up. I get to sleep. Generally, I sleep later than I would when I'm home.
Okay.
You know, so there's so many different little things that could make the difference. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
But I could see it being an interesting thing to research or play with.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whatever.
That's what I have.
Wow. You that was one that we discussed that for a little while. I had something too, but we're not even going to talk about it today.
Oh,
we'll save it for next week.
Onward.
We'll talk about Dr. John Gottman next week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's an interesting researcher.
All right.
In the field of relationships.
Oh, God. Okay.
Great. Okay, Doc. Let's get to the good stuff. What you said that stress is a risk assessment type of approach. But I'm curious. When we talk about helmets are a risk assessment. I guess that's what we could call it. and you're at risk of dying in a motorcycle accident. When you're talking about smoking, you're at risk of getting cancer or even a stroke and possibly heart disease. I think it's heart disease also. But if you are in, if you have stress or a certain level of stress, what are you at risk of?
Okay, you are at risk of basically all of the diseases that we consider part of modernized society, the heart disease, the, you know, various types of cancer, you know, of course, part of heart disease is high blood pressure, various pulmonary dysfunctions, a lot of this stuff, oh, mental illness. Oh, I forgot that. A lot of these problems were not that common 100 years ago, believe it or not. I mean, they existed, you know, but if you look at the various graphs of incidence of these various diseases over the last 50, 75 years, or even 20 years, it is basically parabolic. So what this indicates is that this isn't really a part of the way that humans have evolved, you know, over millions of years. This is something directly due to the stress, being exposed to the stress of how modern society is actually configured. That's the interesting part.
Well, what is parabolic?
Parabolic is like this huge, like increase. It's like a huge, it's not just a little tiny increase over a period of time. It's like when it basically goes vertical if you're looking at a graph.
Okay.
Spike.
Huge spike.
I'm going to challenge you. And my challenge is when I hear people talk about things 100 years ago and how they were better, and I'm not necessarily saying you're wrong, but I'm definitely challenging you. I got a question mark comes up because these things weren't necessarily measured 100 years ago. We didn't know as much. We weren't able to measure or diagnose certain diseases and conditions 100 years ago as we can now. So how can we really compare apples to apples?
Well, actually, you know, that's not entirely true. I mean, you know, diabetes, you know, a lot of these are fairly well documented, you know, I mean, it's not as obscure as we might think it is, because a lot of people, they did not die from these diseases. I mean, of course they died from infectious diseases, women from childbirth. But these, like, from what people die from now, from what they died from, say, you know, around, like, say, 100 years, 120 years ago from, you know, the Industrial Revolution, is completely different. It's just a completely different profile. And then, of course, living here in Ecuador, I've come full circle because, you know, of course, it's a highly socialist country. There's a lot of socialist clinics that are low cost or free. Mm-hmm. And I go to these, you know, because they're in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I can just walk to them. And so when I go to get, like, say, my teeth cleaned or anything like that, I'm noticing over and over and over the 2.5 years I've been here that these clinics are mostly empty. Like, the doctors are waiting for you. There's no line of people. And through this, and, you know, of course, knowing many Ecuadorians and integrating in the culture, they're just not as sick. And why aren't they as sick? You know, they're just not as sick as we are in the U.S. They just aren't. Why is that? Well, it's because they have very strict control of managing their stress. It's a cultural thing.
They're actually
very, very interesting. Very interesting. It's really shocking, honestly.
So, Mary, listening to you, and I'm saying, well, wait a minute. The life expectancy of a child born today is 125 years. Many of the technologies that are making our lives, designed to make our lives easier, more convenient, the unexpected consequence is our lives are more stressful. We could say because we have more options. There are more, you know, we can, thanks to the light bulb, we can read deep into the night and or worse than that, thanks to the iPad, you don't even have to have the light on and you can read deep into the night. So there's this, what you're saying, that, you know, people didn't die from at least the same things, and theoretically at least, it implies that the quality of life was better, and yet we've made the strides we've made because we wanted to improve life. There's also, the other thing that comes up for me is that there are qualities of stress, and that what looks like a stressful lifestyle to me could look like relaxation to someone else. And it's not that I disagree with you per se. It's just that what it means to be stressful, at least in this country, has gotten, there's so much variety to it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, basically, see, unfortunately, because looking at, well, it's actually adaptation. When we're talking about stress, we're talking about collectively the mechanisms of adaptation in any animal, but we'll just focus on people. Basically, you know, in order, the problem is that it's so complex. It's probably the most complex field in science in reality. And this is why it's taken me so long, and this is why there hasn't really been any good, like, analysis up until now with this, because, you know, what level do you want to study? Do you want to study this on the molecular level? You want to study this on the, you know, gross theological level, where we're looking at systems? You want to study this, what various ways on the psychological level do you want to study this? You want to look at this from trauma, workplace stress, relationship stress, yada, yada. Do you want to look at this on the sociological level? What happens, especially now in the geopolitical turbulence, when many people, you know, hundreds of millions of people become very stressed all at once, what happens? Mm. Or do you want to look at this on a political and economic level? The thing is that there's actually five major reasons why stress has exploded in a modern society. And what this does is that this clarifies. It's not that stress is good or bad. It's a mechanism of adapting to demands of the environment.
So what are the five things?
Okay, what are the five? I'm going to go over these really, really quickly. We could, like, do a show for each one of these.
Okay.
And these are very, very surprising. You'll love this. Okay, number one, I call sort of a blanket term complexity. And what I mean by that is undue stress on the mechanisms of what we call executive functioning and working memory, specifically the frontal lobes, the brain behind your forehead and eyeballs.
Right.
And this part of the brain is what makes us distinctly human. This is what has made us leader of the pack, okay? Because what it allows us to do is to take our imagination and project into the future what we want to do. And ultimately, why the stress or why the frontal lobes have evolved to how they are is because they have attenuated our stress. They are our primary stress response organs. Because when you're faced with a stressor as an animal, you've got two choices. You can either change your body to fit the environment. So, like, if you're in a freezing cold environment and you're just a regular animal, you can increase your thyroid hormone function, your fight or flight function in order to produce more heat, increase the metabolism. Or if you're a human with a big, fat frontal lobe, you can say, well, I don't need to do that. I can just sew some clothes or create a fire or, you know, build a house.
Now, let me just stop you for a minute, Mary.
Yeah.
Because now I'm going to, I feel a crazy question coming on.
Go right
so
ahead.
You know how people there. Say, you know how people say, do I look fat in these jeans, right? So now I'm going to turn around and say, honey, do you think I have a big fat frontal lobe? That is like crazy.
Okay.
Oh my God.
That is actually a question to ask.
That's a question to ask. Exactly.
Now, so, what's the acceptable answer?
Of course. Oh, okay. So what are the
other... Is that your frontal lobe right around your belly button?
No. Oh, that's criminal. criminal. That is criminal. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. I'm gonna let it go, Frank. Every show I gotta let something go, Mary. That's gonna be it. So what are the other four, Mary? What are the other four things?
Well, okay. So the problem with the frontal lobe is that when we overtax it, okay, when we're like overcognitive, you see what I'm saying? We're not meant to think and to over strategize and plan and multitask to the level that we are today. And this causes many, many stress related illnesses, believe it or not, including it is the wellspring of how all mental illness. And this is why we've seen a huge spike in mental illness in recent years as well.
Mary,
I'm going to
try something. I'm going to interject a little bit of Frank into this.
Uh-oh.
Go right ahead.
So what I heard you say in terms of complexity, we got into frontal lobe stuff, and I wasn't getting it. What I heard is complexity kind of equals multitasking, doing a lot of things. Or trying to do a lot of things and trying to manage a lot of things at once. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And our ancestors, I mean, we are put together to do small episodic periods of mm-hmm. this type of activity. We are not meant to have it chronically in our face day after day after day. That's not how we're put together.
Okay.
Okay, what's number two? And I'm going to try to frank that one. What you got?
you'll love this. This is a good one. Living in an unequal society, living in a society where resources are very, very unequal, and a lot of us can identify with this, and this also contributes to a huge amount of stress-related disease, early mortality and disability, especially for men. Uh-huh. And the reason for this is that, you know, this kid's a little bit geeky. But when you're like at the bottom of the totem pole, you are basically facing the demands of the environment, you know, head on. You've got the worst access to schools, to adequate housing, safe neighborhoods, to the best jobs. You've got usually the most dangerous or exhausting jobs with the worst scheduling. I mean, everything. When you're the guy at the bottom of the totem pole, you're constantly having to be vigilant. And when that happens, you are actually doing a phase shift mm-hmm. from a more stable aspect of your being to a more plastic, more adaptable. And with that, if you remain in that state for too long, you lose structural integrity. Your tissues actually lose structural integrity, and disease becomes more frequent. You run out of resources. You just don't have the resources to keep equilibrium.
Being an expatriate, do you find that there's a capitalism, socialism conversation in there somewhere?
I wouldn't blame, okay, and I've looked at this extensively. I wouldn't blame capitalism. Pure capitalism is what you see at the farmer's market or a flea market when, you know, you have all these vendors that have the same equal footing, the same, you know, equal opportunity to sell their wares or services. And, you know, that's true capitalism, and that's totally democratic. What we're looking at is a totalitarian fascist where you've had so much corruption that they've destroyed the equal opportunity process. You know, mm-hmm. you've had the fat cats. And this happens over and over in history. This isn't unique. But understand that revolution and revolt, like we're seeing now, are the wellspring of having many, many people, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions, under extreme stress. And this is how society acts. This is how things become unstable. You have to look at how humans react through the light of how they respond to stress.
Do you think the inequality conversation isn't relevant in the U.S. because certainly
it's totally relevant because we're in a very highly unequal society. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, living down here in Ecuador, I realize there's plenty to go around. Mm. There really is. It's not expensive to keep people, you know, basically covered so they're not freaking out.
Okay. What you got on number three?
Number three is closely related. It's loss of social capital, which in a nutshell is a loss of social support. Since the 1850s, you know, the participation in cultural, social, religious groups has declined precipitously. We're just not as social. We don't know our neighbors. We're not as social. And the same thing comes into effect. We are herd animals. You know, we are basically meant to operate in groups, and because groups allow us protection from the direct ravages of the environment. You know, when you have a group to protect you, you're not having to go into that vigilant plastic state where you're always having to deal with the demands of the environment head on. You have protection of your family or your social group. And we've lost that. And that's definitely something different down here in Latin America. That is a huge mitigator of stress.
Now, now you have social media herds. You've got just the herd has changed. How do you incorporate that into the conversation?
I can't exactly address that, but there's something that has to be said about actual human contact.
Right.
You know, and actually like knowing your neighbors. I mean, the neighborhood, the community. Again, all this has, like, been screwed up, you know. I mean, you can't even find a job in the city, you know, where you're educated, so you have to move halfway across the, you know, country. And again, this destroys communities, and not having good jobs to where you feel comfortable with, like, really putting roots in a community because, okay, I'm going to be fired or laid off, and I'm going to have to move another 1,000 miles. So this is a very, very destructive, extremely destructive.
And I think the other thing I think is interesting to point out about what you say about these online social communities mm-hmm. is that often I'm wondering if we can get confused by being in communication with someone online, liking their videos or posts, doesn't exactly give the kind of support that Mary's talking about. And yet the connection to all these people and groups can give you the illusion that you're in community. And I tend to measure my community, actually, by how much of my own stress I can bring to that community and know that I'll be supported. I don't do that online.
Well, don't bring no stress in here.
See what I'm saying, man? Frank and I are an uncommunity. We just happen to be in the same place at the same time for a particular period of time.
Speaking of picking on Nancy.
Oh, my gosh.
Something you said, I want to challenge.
Mm.
So I got one. I've challenged you, Mary, and now I got a challenge for Nancy.
Oh, gee. Okay.
You said that a lot of the advances that we've made have been
designed to make life easier for us.
That's
more
not what
convenient.
You said.
More convenient.
No,
said.
That's
what
not
did
what
I,
you said. Ooh, you
what
said
did I say?
Designed to improve life.
Yeah.
All right. I see. That's different to me. Convenience is different than designed to improve life.
Improve the quality of life.
That's the same. Convenience and I think the quality of life I think those are very similar.
Okay.
But improving life is different. And I see convenience and task.
Mm-hmm.
Convenience is like a way to make a task easier. That's how I see it.
Okay.
And so a car, it doesn't improve your life. It makes getting to where you want to go easier.
Which
and
then reduces my stress, doesn't it?
No, not necessarily.
Well,
because taking the bus isn't necessarily stressful, and walking isn't necessarily stressful. In fact, walking is a form of exercise which can reduce stress.
Yes.
Now, if you own a car, and it's a stretch to say people who own cars aren't stressed.
No question.
So
okay,
I just
but people who own cars and don't have GPS. got one foot in the grave and the other one on a banana peel. Let me just say. So you just, you know, you may have one, you know, piece of technology or advance or technology.
Yes. And you get dependent on another one?
Oh, my goodness.
So I guess my point is many of the advances that we made are not to improve life. They're to improve task.
Okay.
And there's a difference. I really believe. The one improvement that I see as hands down a something that has improved life is penicillin.
Okay.
And but yet I don't really know if over time penicillin is a life improver.
Penicillin just extended life.
It may, but it also, given where we are around antibiotics now,
right.
Developing staph infections and you know, penicillin resistant infections, they may become a super bug that just wipes us out as a result of having had penicillin. Mm-hmm. So it may seem like it was an advancement, but it's possibly it will destroy us all. That's just a theory. And so when I think about advancements, I don't really know if an iPad, an iPhone, a car is truly an advancement. It's just made a given task easier. What do you think, Mary?
Well, I mean, you're definitely, you know, on to something. You know, you're really, really kind of grasping the deep existential aspects of this.
Don't call him deep and existential, Mary. I gotta sit here with this guy. Now he's deep and existential. That just killed it for me.
The hate. So please continue, Mary. On, you were saying something really important.
I'm not sure if it's all that important, but I'll try. It's okay. Well, let me tell you what the definition of stress is. So it will sort of segue into what, you know, you were talking about, Frank. The definition of stress is the rate of adjustment that you undergo in order to adapt to whatever environment you happen to find yourself in. So there's two aspects. There's, you know, the individual agency, and then you have, you know, the stuff that the environment throws at you. Some of it is better, and some of it, depending on the environment, is more hostile. Mm-hmm. And so, exactly. It's more, Frank, you hit the nail on the head. It's more the just flat out complexity, the flat out just moving parts that we have that our ancestors did not. And, you know, and dealing with this, and again, if you think about it, if you look at it, like, say, as a thermodynamic system, any system, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a car. You know, if it's like, say, a bicycle versus a car as far as complexity, or if it's, you know, a community, or if it's something with, like, a lot of technology, the more complex the system is, the more apt to break down that you're going to have because it's got more moving parts. Mm-hmm. And that's basically all you have to, you know, take home. And the thing with, like, treating stress as a risk assessment is that, you know, since people don't have a vocabulary now, and I want to give them the vocabulary, and because stress is probably the biggest risk that we have in our society right now, is to understand that the more complex that you have, to pick and choose your battles, to pick and choose what is most worth your expenditure of energy as a human being to deal with. There's a lot of stuff that you can cut out that will, you know, very likely add, you know, 5, 10, maybe 20 years to your life, quality years. And then there's stuff that, you know, you do that's just kind of part of the machine that is very likely, especially as you get older, you know, it's very likely statistically apt to make you quite sickly and prone to a very, very risky breakdown. And which could affect, of course, your family, especially if you're a sole breadwinner.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with author and researcher Dr. Mary Wingo about stress. Dr. Wingo, what are you up to, and how can our listeners find you, your book, whatever have you?
Yes. Well, they can, first off, they can go to my website, marywingo.com. That's marywingo.com. And they can get a bunch of free information because this is really, really important. Mm-hmm. This is extremely important, especially right now where people are quite fearful about their future, what's going on in the U.S. and in Europe, too. Well, basically all modernized societies right now. And they can pick up a copy of my book, The Impact of the Human Stress Response. This is a must-have. It's very inexpensive, and it's a must-have for anybody trying to get a hold of this, to really, really to get a handle and to get their head around this. And additionally, I am available for workshops to help set up frameworks, as well as consulting and possibly tutoring as well for health professionals, so they can disseminate this knowledge for their clients and patients.
Number four, the last one was loss of social capital or social support. What's number four?
Number four is completely different, and this is going to shock you. It is the derangement or depletion of the human biome, and what the biome is are those critters, those little microorganisms of different sorts that have co-evolved over millions of years in our gut, on our skin, and in our orifices. Mm-hmm. And basically what they do, they're extensions of our body. They're extensions of our functioning, of our bodily functions. So, for instance, they're involved with synthesis of certain vitamins, of other digestive functioning, of immune signaling, endocrine signaling, cellular growth signaling. So basically, we have like certain ratios of microorganisms, on and in us. And because of the exposure, especially the chemical stress, various, like say, processed food, antibiotics, the various chemicals we have for hygiene, industrial, you name it, stuff that really didn't exist maybe much 50, 100 years ago or even 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Well, because of that, we've lost a lot of our microbial friends. And with that, we've lost a lot of basic physiological functioning.
So
well, when
now
you do that,
we're...
your body's going to go into the stress response, and that's going to be a very potent stressor for your body to contend with since it's out of equilibrium.
Okay,
it's just trying to keep you alive. It's just trying to keep you adapting, whether you're well or not.
This is why the vitamin shop is making a gazillion dollars on probiotics and digestive enzymes. And I submit to you, the lotion and potion industry is going to kill us because I'm a firm believer that if you can't eat it, don't put it on your skin.
That's right.
However,
that's right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's a big mistake. I follow that myself. Just like for my own, because I totally practice what I preach, but I bet you I've taken minimum 10 years off of myself just following this simple routine.
I like that. If you can't eat it,
don't put it on your skin. Your skin
That's
is
right.
an organ.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
What about other organs?
If you can't eat it, don't put it on there either.
Uh-huh.
Mary, this has been the Frank Love Show, and I just want to thank you.
Want me to weigh in on that?
I think we've woken up Jeff.
No comment.
Yeah. Boy,
gosh.
yes.
That does lead to a better life quality.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
So, Mary, let us move on with the interview.
Here we go. Maybe we can narrow it down, but if you can't digest it, don't put it on your skin.
Same soup, different bowl.
Okay, all right.
Whatever. But, Mary, you talked about how living in a society that has more moving parts by extension generates more stress. And then you talked about living in Ecuador. And so I'm saying, well, can we really take anything from a society like Ecuador? If it doesn't have as many moving parts, then let's say the average New Yorker is going to be like, don't talk to me about Ecuador. I'm in
the Chelsea, moving right? parts of the capital
yes,
of the world.
Yes. So in a place where, let's say like Washington, D.C. or New York, where people are just trying to get through the next five or 10 minutes. If you say, well, in Ecuador they do this or in Ecuador they do that, it doesn't feel relevant.
Mm. And all right.
Well, it's because honestly, there's no other way to, we've been brainwashed into thinking that just persistent, nonstop modernization. And I'm not sure if I exactly call it process, but just the change, the technological change in modernization is completely beneficial. I mean, yeah, there have been many beneficial aspects. We don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. And, of course, Ecuador is actually quite advanced. I mean, you know, they've adopted the good aspects of this. But, I mean, it's just a trade-off. I mean, it's not bad or good. It's just, depending. I mean, you know, do you want to be part of the most medicated society in the world millennials and Gen Xers that aren't reproducing and boomers that are actually quite sick and, you know, comparison to their parents from the Great Depression? Or, it depends. It's what it is. I just want your listeners to have this information so they can make the judgment call themselves. A lot of people don't even have access to this type of information. So they even know what they're doing could, you know, risk, you know, the well-being of their family or, you know, the right. well-being, you know, their ability to function and survive, since you do need a lot of money in our society. The ability to keep that machine going is becoming very, very difficult for a lot of families.
Right.
And so, yeah, and but the good news is that a lot of this is preventable. You know, this is in your control. You don't have to depend on a collapsing medical system or collapsing government system, you know, where nobody knows what the hell is going on. You can take this on yourself. Just like I said, just like you would, you know, you can make the risk assessment whether to smoke or not. This is something perfectly doable and viable, and it's very inexpensive. It's not something that, you know, you have to be wealthy, or part of or insured even to capitalize on.
I got a weigh-in piece there also.
Okay.
You can live a version of minimalistically, or if that's a word, in D.C. also. I mean, so one of the things is there's a keeping up with the Joneses component that you can opt out of.
Okay.
That's right.
There's a iPhone, Android thing that, you know, every time a new one comes out, that's
you have
stress.
To have it.
You
yes.
got to have
that's
it.
That's right.
You can
that's
opt
right.
out of that.
Yes.
You can opt out of having a car note.
Sure.
You can own a car that's reliable, that you own for 10 years, that you bought for $5,000.
Yes.
That's possible. And so that's a way of opting out of that lifestyle. You can own a home that has been maybe passed down to generations in your family. You can own a home with another family. You can not own a home and just opt out of that lifestyle altogether and
okay.
just choose to rent.
True.
And when it's time to go, when things are not good here anymore, we're going to rent somewhere else. There are all types of ways to opt out of the keeping up with the Joneses lifestyle.
Right.
That is
killing a lot of people.
It's killing us, but it's also in many ways, it's the purpose of marketing. The purpose of marketing is to get you to buy something or spend your money on something. And if you kind of close those channels off to the point where you're just not, you don't
you're
watch
in it, but not of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're
okay.
not even, it's, I've heard a family years ago. I was watching a television show. Or the news or something. I was watching something, and they had an agreement with their children where they can't buy anything that they see on television or that they see on a commercial.
Oh, okay.
And it's a way of opting out of
the bombardment of advertising, directing your attention and your dollars.
Yeah.
and using your children to do it, because they most certainly do.
Absolutely.
Can I interject something about the marketing phenomenon? You have to understand that the U.S., if we're masters of anything, or, I mean, you know, we're masters of a lot, but we are masters of the concept and the practice of marketing. I mean, we created this discipline, business and academic discipline, and we are the absolute leaders of the world of the science of marketing. We created it mainly in the 50s after World War II when the fat cats at the top wanted a way to, you know, make more money. So they created the consumer society with financing in order, you know, to create, you know, a richer banking system and all that, and to stimulate demand. And so our culture created that. It is much less prevalent in especially the developing countries. The art of marketing is not as developed, or more old school, like classifieds in newspapers rather than, like, say, Google advertisements.
Got it.
Hmm.
You anything, Nancy?
Yeah. My head is kind of just spinning with stuff, Mary. Okay, so I'm going in my mind. I'm on one track, and I'm trying to be on another track in the conversation. So I hear Mary saying a couple of things. She's talking about stress from a more aggregate level. So it's not about, say, just breathing deeply or getting a meditation practice. Mm-hmm. That's what we do on an individual level. You're talking about what we do as a collective. I'm thinking about a friend of mine who lives in Spain, and she had traveled there before she moved. And one of the things she came back with is, Nance, they like shut down for 3 hours in the middle of the day for siesta. Though, I mean, like, everything stops
for siesta. What is siesta?
Yes,
it's a
time when you take a rest. You
during
take
the day, every day,
every single day. Businesses close, restaurants close. Now, what that means is that things stay open a little later.
Mm-hmm.
However, people have an opportunity to stop, to refresh themselves, and then get back into the day. And so even though this is a modern, complex society, they take that time out, and then it makes them more available all the way around going into the rest of the day. I know that, if I'm not mistaken, Google, because I'm thinking about how this works out on a corporate level, Google has sleep suites. So if you get tired, there's a place right there at work you can go to take a nap and come back and jump back into your day. If they had a place where I work, to where I could go take a nap every once in a while, oh my goodness.
You mean on with the approval of your supervisor, not like what you do now?
Again, Mary, I'm going to let that go.
Can I interject about Google? Actually,
please.
Actually, Google is, employee workplace stress is probably one of the largest, if not largest, sunk costs that most complex institutions or businesses have. And Google, because they do hire geniuses and they need a lot of performance.
Yes.
So whenever you have a situation where you have humans, where you want high performance, then you have to do stuff like that. You have to do stuff that decreases the usual components of that cause workplace stress.
Yes, and
so,
Mary.
Yeah, I mean, a 10-15 minute nap ain't going to mean anything if you've got some sort of programmer that's creating some sort of app that's going to generate tens of billions.
But here's the thing about what you're saying on a couple of levels. Number one, a lot of what makes a person a genius is how we listen to them. So if a guy is a genius in one area, I know a guy, he's a genius in anatomy and physiology.
Come
he fumbles
on,
the
we,
ball everywhere else.
It's not anatomy and physiology that I'm a genius
well, I
about.
Got, And I'm not talking about this guy, right? However, so number one, a lot of what makes a person a genius, and I'm not taking anything away from genius, is how you listen to a person. So what you're saying to me is that if I don't work for Google, then I don't warrant as an employee a certain quality of work environment that would maximize my productivity.
Now,
I know that's not what you're saying. I'm saying at these higher corporate levels, if the guy who's running Google is saying, you know what, I need a place where my employees can get a decent bite to eat without having to leave the building and hustle through traffic. If a guy's tanking, I need a place for him to go and, you know, grab a few minutes, grab a cat nap. So that he can be more productive. What we have is businesses and agencies that want people to be more productive, and yet nothing is being done on the human side to aid that productivity. So
you call yourself
automating. So, okay, we're going to automate this particular process, and now what used to take you an hour should take you 15 minutes. That may be true, but then what you're going to do is give me more of it to do. So now you've not helped me, you've helped yourself. Theoretically you've helped yourself. Because if I can't decompress someplace, then my productivity takes a dive, your expectations go through the roof, and then I'm not able to meet them, and bang, we have more stress.
That's right.
A cycle.
And I don't know how well you keep up. I keep up with the economics and the finance, because this is all related to human stress. We're losing our competitive edge. Constantly having people stressed out, freaked out that they're going to lose their job, especially now, and just piling it on. It ultimately destroys. And we're seeing that. Despite all the lies and manipulation of corporate earnings, corporate earnings are actually tanking. The elite, again, this is all due to the elite just being unregulated and taking more than their fair share and just saying to hell with everybody else and to hell with even like the company, because they're getting their golden parachutes. They don't care. So they don't care whether this particular institution, government office, branch or anything like that exists beyond them, because they're getting theirs. And if they're not going to work there 20 years, they're probably going to be there 3 to 5 years like everybody else. And so they get their golden parachute. And it is a not dealing with human stress, especially in this highly automated society, is destroying profitability. It's a huge destruction of profitability. You're absolutely right.
I'm curious about this, and there's no reason to, other than you being interested in the topic, you certainly haven't said anything about Arabic or Islam. What do I want to say? Islamic countries. Mm-hmm, yeah, that's what I want to say. Mm-hmm. But there's people who are Muslim. They pray 5 times a day.
Yes,
and that kind of seems like an opportunity to decompress.
Yeah.
How do you see, or are you aware of, a lesser level of stress in Muslim countries, or primarily Muslim Islam practicing countries?
Well, what's going on, and this is more geographical than it is religious, and of course I see this from a different, completely different aspect, is because many of Islam encompasses more than a billion folks, so it's quietly dispersed. But a lot of what we think of is the Middle East. Well, the Middle East is very resource rich with especially oil and like right. oil pipelines and, you know, very strategic, you know, like, you know, Israel is a great strategic base for, you know, the U.S. to be, you know, to get their empire building done. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what we think of the Muslim countries is the like Syria and Iraq, where, you know, through actions, not just the U.S., but of Europe as well and others, we've destroyed these countries trying to extract their resources. They're usually oil. That's usually oil mm-hmm. or some other strategic. And so it's very stressful. And that's, again, look at the light of the universe. This is the reason why the refugee crisis exists when, you know, you've had, you know, literally over 20 years, millions of people killed. You're going to have a very traumatized society. And, you know, of course, when you bomb the hell out of it and you don't have any jobs or any infrastructure or schools, well, of course, you're going to want to go to greener pastures, even mm-hmm. though you might not want to. So we're looking, you know, at these particular societies because they've been under attack through empire building. You know, again, this is all the fat cats, you know, yep. unregulated, not being stopped. There's no other reason. There's no other moral reason. So, yes, it's very stressful. But again, these are old. These are called what's called, instead of hot societies, which change a lot, they're more traditional. And so, you know, you've got what works, what's worked in a lot of these societies for thousands of years. And they know in many ways how to mitigate stress. And yes, absolutely. Religion is a giant stress mitigator. This is why it is evolved. No matter what the society is, stress is a giant mitigator of stress. Religion is a giant mitigator of stress for many people.
Well, as we wrap up, we're missing one thing, and that's number five. What's number five?
Number five. Okay, real quick, this is easy, and this kind of relates to number four. This is just flat-out chemical stress. Again, this isn't just depletion of the biome. This is the fact that we are exposing ourselves to novel chemical compounds that didn't exist. We don't have the mechanisms. You know, we have it. It takes, you know, many, many thousands of years to evolve, you know, new types of enzymes to break down.
Does that kind of mean pollution?
And we just haven't evolved it. And when we are exposed to this, and this includes pollution of the air, soil, and water, then we go into a stress response to try to keep equilibrium. And that also results in a huge amount of death worldwide, not just in the U.S., but worldwide.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we've been talking with author and researcher Dr. Mary Wingo about stress. One more time, Dr. Wingo, what are you up to and how can our listeners find you?
Well, your listeners can come to my website, marywingo.com. That's marywingo.com for a ton of free information. They can sign up for a free portion of my book, which outlines true, effective, actionable stress management tips based in science. And they can also pick up a copy of my book, The Impact of the Human Stress Response. One of the most important books of our age right now, and it's a humanitarian project. And they can also contact me for if they need my help, you know, as far as consulting, tutoring, some sort of educational framework put together to get this message out.
Along today's journey, we've discussed improvements of life versus improvements of task, stress responses, and causes of stress. Thank you to my co-host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer. And thank you to my guest, Dr. Patricia Wingo. You've been great. Oh, yeah. Dr. Mary Wingo. I'm sorry.
He's a little stressed, man.
I hope you've had as much fun
as still early in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. I hope you've had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's MR Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there. And if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.